Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Recklessness and Misdemeanor Crimes of Domestic Violence Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 29, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Voisin v. United States. Stephen Voisin was convicted in 2003 of assaulting a woman with whom he was in a domestic relationship, a misdemeanor violation of a Maine statute. In 2009, Voisin turned a rifle over to federal officials who were investigating him for a separate alleged crime. When investigators discovered Voisin's 2003 misdemeanor assault, they charged him under 18 U.S.C. 922 G9, which makes it a federal crime for a person who has been convicted in any court of a misdemeanor crime for domestic violence to possess in or affecting commerce any firearm or ammunition. In turn, a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence is defined in 921A33A as an offense that, one, is a misdemeanor under federal, state, or tribal law, and two, has as an element the use or attempted use of physical force committed by a current or former spouse, parent, or guardian of the victim, or by a person in a similar domestic relationship with the victim. Voisin challenged the 922 G9 charge, arguing that under his main conviction, offensive physical contact, as opposed to one causing bodily injury, was not a use of physical force, and thus not a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, within the meaning of 921A33A. The district court rejected this argument, and Voisin pled guilty on condition that he be able to appeal the court's ruling. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit affirmed the district court's judgment, but the Supreme Court subsequently granted Voisin's petition for certiorari, vacated the First Circuit's judgment, and remanded the case for reconsideration in light of the intervening 2014 Supreme Court decision, United States v. Castleman. That decision held the requirement of physical force satisfied for purposes of 922 G9 by the degree of force that supports a common law battery conviction, but it did not resolve whether a conviction with the mens rea of reckless, as under the Maine statute, would qualify. On remand, the First Circuit again rejected Voisin's challenge and held that his Maine conviction qualified as a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. The Supreme Court again granted certiorari to address the following question: whether a misdemeanor crime with the mens rea of recklessness qualifies as a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, as defined by 18 U.S.C. 921A33A and 922 G9. To discuss the case, we have Ryan Scott, who is Associate Professor at Indiana University Maurer School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Scott.
Justice Thomas speaks as the Supreme Court considers whether a misdemeanor crime of violence under Section 922 G9 of Title 18 includes a state law misdemeanor that extends to recklessly causing injury. The big headline from this case was that Justice Thomas began asking questions for the first time in over a decade. But I'll start today by talking through the legal issues in the case, giving my assessment of how oral argument went, both for the petitioners and for the government, and then talking about this surprising colloquy near the end of the argument at which Justice Thomas weighed in for the first time in over a decade. Federal law, as you may know, makes it a crime for a convicted felon to possess a firearm. Congress recognized a special risk for non-felons, for people who are guilty of misdemeanors, in the context of domestic violence. And in 1996, Congress enacted a new provision, Section 922 G9, which makes it a federal crime for a person who's been convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence to possess a firearm. The Congress saw itself as closing a loophole here, that people who were guilty of domestic abuse posed a special risk when they possess firearms. The statute defines a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence as any offense that is a misdemeanor, whether that's under federal or state law, and which has as an element the use or attempted use of physical force committed by certain people with domestic relationships to the victim, so spouses, former spouses, parents, children, etc. 2 terms ago, in a case called United States versus Castleman, the Supreme Court answered one unsettled interpretive question about this misdemeanor crime of domestic violence definition. Is it necessary that the misdemeanor under state law involve violent contact with the victim? You can imagine offenses that are misdemeanors under state law that involve bodily injury, but not necessarily violent contact, things like poisoning someone to make them sick or inflicting a slight non-serious injury without any violent contact. And the Supreme Court, in interpreting other similar provisions of federal law, like the Armed Career Criminal Act, had said that violent contact is required when we're talking about the use of force, use of force against another person. In this case, in Castleman, though, the Supreme Court unanimously concluded that a violent contact was not required. And in doing so, the court drew on the common law of battery. It said, just as battery at common law involves any slight touching, any offensive touching, doesn't require any physical violence in the ordinary sense of that term, the Supreme Court said that Congress had that definition in mind, and it reached that conclusion and distinguished Armed Career Criminal Act cases on the basis that domestic violence is different, that what Congress had in mind in addressing a problem of domestic violence, that's a term of art that goes beyond physical violence and includes a range of conduct that may result in physical injury, where the injury is slight, but nonetheless was within Congress's contemplation when it created this provision. So Castleman sets up the legal issue in this new case, Voisin. What if the state law misdemeanor reaches unintentional infliction of bodily injury? Does that offense involve the use of force within the statutory definition? So in this case, the petitioners, Stephen Voisin and William Armstrong, both pleaded guilty to misdemeanors defined under state law in Maine as intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causing bodily injury or offensive physical contact to another person. Recklessly here means not intentionally injuring someone, but consciously disregarding the risk that an injury would be inflicted on the victim. The court in Castleman had explicitly reserved that question, whether reckless conduct was enough, but it had noted in a footnote that in the Armed Career Criminal Act context, that's violent felonies, the courts of appeals have almost uniformly held that recklessness is not sufficient. So this case presents that question directly, but specific to misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence. The case was argued on February 29th. This is barely 2 weeks after Justice Scalia has passed away. Only 8 members of the court are sitting, and if the court is going to make a decision on Voisin this term, only 8 justices will cast votes. I'll describe the argument in 3 parts. I'll start with a description of the argument by the federal public defender from Wisconsin, Virginia Villa, who argued on behalf of the petitioners. And then I'll explain why I think, notwithstanding some nice hypotheticals raised by the petitioners, the government is likely to prevail in this case. I think the court is likely to conclude that recklessly causing injury does fall within the definition of a use of physical force for purposes of this statute. And then finally, I'll turn to the big wild card here, Justice Thomas's introduction into the discussion of Second Amendment concerns that arguably influence the interpretation of the statute. So first, Ms. Villa's argument, overall, I think she had a tough sledding. She got a lot of difficult questions from Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Ginsburg on her statutory interpretation arguments, on the common law arguments based on the definition of battery at common law. But I will say she had some nice hypotheticals. Over the course of the argument, she raised a series of examples of conduct that involve reckless infliction of injury that may be against a family member, and that seem like they are far removed from Congress's concern in the act about the kind of domestic abusers that would pose a special risk when it comes to firearms. For example, she used the example of someone who is running away from an assailant and while fleeing slams the door behind them to try to get away and slams the pursuer's fingers in the door. That's an unintentional injury. It might be a reckless injury, a conscious disregard of the risk of physical injury. But someone who's running away hardly seems like the sort of domestic abuser who Congress might have had in mind. Another example, in a fight in the car during an argument, you've got a spouse or a child in the car, you get in a car accident. That might involve reckless infliction of bodily injury, and the mere fact that it's a family member who's injured might transform that offense into a predicate for a permanent disability from possessing a firearm on the basis that it's a domestic crime, a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. Those seem like a real stretch under the statute outside of Congress's idea. Nonetheless, Justice Kagan in particular was pretty relentless in saying, don't those all involve uses of force within the meaning of the statute? Using a vehicle to cause injury is a use of force. Using a door or a gun or any other implement to inflict injury is nonetheless a use of force. On the whole, I would say the court was reluctant to get into the weeds of the common law definition of battery and seemed more eager to resolve this case on the ordinary language of a use of force, and saw this as all as examples of uses of force that, whether recklessly or intentionally, nonetheless result in an injury to the victim. So I think the government is likely to prevail in this case. The Castleman decision did look to the common law of battery as a reference point, and I think the court is likely to say that it did so only to decide whether violent contact was required, and that recklessly causing an injury still involves the use of force. A number of justices on the court who were in the majority in decisions like Leocal and Johnson, where the court had narrowly construed the meaning of a violent felony under the provisions of the Armed Career Criminal Act, seemed quite receptive to the government's argument that those provisions were textually distinguishable. That provision involves a use of force against another person, and also distinguishable in terms of Congress's underlying purpose. As Justice Sotomayor noted, many prototypical examples of domestic violence involve reckless conduct that leads to violence, for example, from drunkenness. And Justice Alito was surprisingly on board with the government's position from the beginning and was quite hostile to the arguments from the petitioners. He noted that most battery offenses in 1996 are defined as including reckless conduct. And so accepting the petitioner's argument that as a categorical matter, all recklessness battery offenses and recklessness assault offenses are excluded would mean that 34 states and the District of Columbia, those basic statutes would be outside the scope of the prohibition in 922 G9. And it's hard to imagine that Congress meant for its new law to close a loophole would operate only in a handful of jurisdictions that happen to require intentional conduct. As to the hypotheticals that the petitioners raised, I think the majority will be and should be untroubled by them. After all, recklessness means consciously disregarding a risk. If a person who's driving a car or slamming a door consciously thinks to themselves, my wife or my child or my girlfriend could be injured by this, and proceeds to take that risk anyway and injures them, that very much does sound like an act of domestic violence. Justice Sotomayor used an excellent counterexample, a person who in anger hurls a plate into the wall near their wife or girlfriend's head, not intending to strike them, but knowing there's a risk that the plate could injure them, and indeed it does. It shatters against the wall and the shards of the plate cause an injury. That sure sounds like an act of domestic abuse, even though the state of mind is merely recklessness. So I think the court is likely to accept the government's statutory interpretation arguments here, distinguish Castleman, and reach the conclusion, at least by a 5-3 vote. And I actually think that Chief Justice Roberts will likely join that opinion as well. So what's the big wild card, and why did Voisin get so much press attention? Justice Thomas broke a decades-long silence on the bench to ask a question when the argument was essentially over. The government's attorney, Ilana Eisenstein, had lots of time left and had asked if there are no further questions and seemed to be tiptoeing toward her chair. As a former government lawyer, I can tell you that's a sign that things are going well for you. When you get to speak uninterrupted for long segments of your argument, when the panel runs out of questions, that's a sign that the court is receptive to your position. And surprisingly, Justice Thomas pipes in by asking the following question. This is a misdemeanor violation, Justice Thomas said. It suspends a constitutional right, the right to bear arms. Can you give me another area where a misdemeanor violation suspends a constitutional right? The government's lawyer was, I think it's fair to say, taken aback by the question, and almost certainly by the questioner. I've read some press accounts of this exchange. Some of them suggested that he merely asked a single question. That's not true. This was a sustained colloquy. Justice Thomas spent about 10 minutes grilling the counsel for the government about whether there are other instances where a single misdemeanor violation can result in a suspension of a constitutional right. Another set of articles have suggested this was a really off-topic diversion by Justice Thomas. That's not true either. The reason that it matters whether this is a Second Amendment problem is that the court frequently uses the avoidance of constitutional difficulties as a factor in its statutory interpretation cases. It's true that the parties had raised the Second Amendment challenge. The petition for writ of certiorari included that issue, and the court declined to review it. But that doesn't mean that concerns about the constitutionality of the statute might not induce the court to prefer a narrower interpretation of the language of the statute. The court does that all the time. And so Justice Thomas really zeroed in on the fact that this statute affects a permanent suspension of a constitutional right after a single misdemeanor conviction for recklessly causing injury against the right kind of family member. You can never possess a gun for the rest of your life. It's based on a mere misdemeanor, which is different from felon in possession statutes, different from things like felon disenfranchisement, where a felony conviction is well established as a constitutional basis for suspending rights. And the misdemeanor actually has nothing to do with weapon use. Both of the petitioners in this case were convicted not for using a firearm or any deadly weapon. They caused bodily injury through conduct that had nothing to do with firearms, and yet a firearm is the right that is being suspended, the right to bear arms. Justice Breyer piped in and asked, do we need to confront the Second Amendment question? Was this a reasonable regulation within the meaning of Heller and other decisions? As a bottom line matter, I don't think that this additional point, this constitutional concern, will influence the court's decision. I think it can save that question for another day. I also don't think that Justice Breyer, despite asking a question about it, is actually receptive to the argument or would break ranks with the rest of the court. I think Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Alito are strongly in the government's side in this case, and I don't think anything that Justice Thomas raises at the end is likely to influence that decision. Perhaps he'll write separately to address this point, perhaps he'll dissent, but I can't imagine it's going to influence a wide swath of the court on this issue. Nonetheless, it's the kind of questioning, and if he decides to write an opinion that raises this issue, it's the sort of topic that might come up in future petitions for certiorari, future challenges. So this might suggest down the road that we might get other Second Amendment challenges to this statute. It might suggest further limits on misdemeanor convictions as a basis for suspensions of individual constitutional rights. But the most encouraging sign, I think, is it might suggest that Justice Thomas is going to get involved in oral argument more frequently. And that would be a welcome development. His voice during oral arguments is one that's been sorely lacking. And it can't be a coincidence that he chose to pipe up just a couple weeks after Justice Scalia has passed away. I imagine that he's got positions that he thinks are going to be undercovered in the absence of his longtime colleague and close intellectual ally, Justice Scalia, on the court. And I think this is a positive development. I'd like to see more from Justice Thomas at oral argument, so this is a good sign that he might weigh in more frequently with the kind of smart, unexpected questions that keep advocates on their toes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.